Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. And you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Migrant caravan continues north, defying Mexico and the United States. A caravan of several thousand Honduran migrants have crossed into Mexico, defying Mexico's offer to let smaller groups of the caravan in each day and deepening a regional migration crisis, while President Trump threatens to seal the U.S.-Mexico border and to stop sending humanitarian aid to Central American countries. All of this to prevent them from coming into the United States. What's going on here and what's at stake? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He has a full-time focus on immigration law and heads the Garcia and Garcia law firms in their San Antonio, Texas office. He is Carlos Castaneda. Welcome back, Carlos, to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be back on the Critical Hour, especially during these, quite frankly, critical times.
So to my first question, Carlos, what's going on here? There are, by last account, close to 8,000 primarily Hondurans who have joined in this caravan. I know that the caravan tends to be an annual or close to an annual event, but this is one of the largest ones in recent memory, correct?
Indeed. And what's important to keep in mind is this. One, that even though this is not the first caravan that has brought its way from Central America through Mexico to reach the United States, this is one of the first ones that has reached this level of political consciousness and attention in the United States. You're going to hear a lot more about such caravans in the Central American news, in the Mexican news media, not so much in the United States. And that is one of the major things that, from my perspective, has changed recently.
So do you have any idea of what's behind this? There are some who would say, you know, if I were a Republican, I'd spend everything I could to have paid for this, because in some circles, this is galvanizing, or Donald Trump is using this to galvanize support in Arizona, in Mexico. There are those who are even in New York and Pennsylvania that are looking at this and saying, oh, this is horrible. And no, we the locusts are coming and we can't have this. So, you know, there are those who wonder, well, is Republican money behind this, or what's driving this?
I would say that there are three main factors. One of which is the fact that people band together in order to maintain safety. Crossing the border into the United States has always been its own source of trouble. Crossing the border through Central America and Mexico, I would say, is a more dangerous journey, quite frankly, based on what I know from clients telling me about their experiences. And I'm not just talking about Central Americans making the journey. I'm talking about people from Africa and Asia who, for whatever reason, trafficking routes take them through Central America from as far south as Panama or Colombia all the way through Mexico via land route until they reach the United States. And I do know of people, many people, getting jumped during that journey. So the main reason factor is protection. The second one is people who are interested in, shall we say, the human rights aspect of migration and making sure that migrants, regardless of whether or not they're able to win an asylum case in the United States or wherever it is they are heading, some do have plans to make it all the way to Canada, they want them to be able to organize, make themselves heard. And so that, shall we say, organizational aspect and groups banding together to protect individuals and make them heard, that's another aspect. The third thing I would mention is that given the success in bringing attention to individuals' plight during the last caravan, which was, or at least the last major caravan that got news in the United States just a few months ago, I think that that initial success has prompted people to try to do the same thing in this moment with a larger group.
Got you. Okay. So talk a little bit about those organizations that are focused on the plight of migrants, because there have been some names. Unfortunately, I don't have the names of any of them in front of me, but I know that there are some organizations that are based in Guatemala and are based in Honduras who organize these caravans and facilitate the migration?
Well, first of all, it's important to say that it's no one particular group behind this, and there's a big aspect of just, I think the word I'm looking for is, well, actually it's blanking on me at the moment, but it's not because people are paid or told to join this group. It's because through word of mouth, people hear about a caravan, in this case, coming together, and then they pass it along through word of mouth or via WhatsApp. WhatsApp is very common, more common than maybe Americans realize in much of the developing world, and then that's how people communicate, and then they come and join up. So as long as you start something, you will find that it grows and grows. One organization that has been responsible for prior caravans, or at least helping them along, is one known as Pueblo Sin Fronteras, which literally translates to Pueblo, so either the people or the community without borders.
Mm-hmm.
Back in April, when one caravan that was primarily organized by Pueblo Sin Fronteras, that was one that reached a lot of attention here in the United States. I believe we may have spoken about that a few months ago.
Yes, we did.
Yes. In this occasion, from what I know, there's no one particular group responsible for this one. I can't say too much as to what brought about the organization of this, but like I said, the factors that brought us to this point are very salient. And that last factor that I mentioned, the success or at least attention to that last caravan, that is one thing that has brought many people either individually or through organizations to say, yes, it's better if we band together.
Talk a little bit, please, about what we've been seeing on television in terms of, I think it's the Guatemalan border, all these people on the bridge. You had a woman with her two children that went down or over the bridge on a makeshift ladder to a makeshift raft. There's an awful lot of there's also been confrontation between the migrants and the police. And it was interesting to me that two things. One, that the police, at least in the stories that I was hearing, are unarmed, which is a good idea. And the second, there seems to be a lot of democracy within the caravan in terms of people had choices about where to go, what camps to go to, where to stay overnight. People were raising their hands and counting votes and making decisions with a very, very stable, calm, direct democracy.
And that's very interesting that we're seeing this, because, and I really do think that this is a consequence of, shall we say, prior experiences and, shall we say, tried and true methods about how people, large groups of people who do not know each other, who have not initially agreed to be a part of, shall we say, a semi-democratic system, they are using these same democratic aspects in order to make their group a bit more cohesive. Because as I understand it, the last caravan, the one back in April, the last major caravan, it kind of dissipated towards later, and many individuals ended up seeking asylum in Mexico, which they are allowed to do. All of them are allowed to do that. Whether or not they'll be successful and whether or not they'll be better off is an entirely different question. But I think those prior experiences have led organizers or individuals within such groups to learn that giving individuals a stake in decision-making makes them more invested in the success of the group as a whole.
In fact, the story I was thinking about just came to mind. It was the mayor from one of the towns along the Mexico border who arrives to the caravan in a truck, and he's trying to convince the migrants to come to be processed. And the group doesn't believe that if they follow him, that they will actually be processed. Many of them believe that something else would happen to them. So a group of six said, we'll go with you and come back and report to the rest of the group. And this was voted on, and they decided that that would be the tack that they would take. It, again, incredibly organized. And also talk about the faith element in this, because one of the things from interviews that I've heard from the caravan, it always ends with God will make a way. There is an incredible faith element here that a lot of these people are operating from.
Yes, indeed. And as to the faith element, I suppose two things that I want to make your listeners aware of is that for the Latino community, faith and God have always been very important, not just from an individual perspective, but also in terms of community. And so if you want to choose one thing that helps bring people from different backgrounds, from different towns, or even different countries together, that faith aspect is something that definitely is something helpful. The second point I want to make is that from what I have seen in just the last few years, I have become aware of the increasingly significant and also increasing numbers of evangelicals in Central America. I know that as a stereotype goes, all Latin America, that's all Catholicism, and principally that would be true. However, the number of evangelicals who have been coming to the United States, the number who are in...
Well, wait a minute. Let me be sure I understand what you said. You said that the stereotype here is that evangelicals are Catholic?
No. I'm saying Central Americans.
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha. Because I was going to know, here they're Protestant. Go ahead.
Yeah. Indeed. Yes. So the number of evangelical churches that have been springing up in Central America especially has something that, from my point of view as a Mexican-American, has been surprising, and it's brought me more appreciation of those changes that are occurring in Central America. Now, I make that note just so that people are aware that this is not just a homogeneous religious aspect, that the idea of God cuts beyond religious denominations. But as you rightfully pointed out, the religious aspect here is something that has definitely been used in order to maintain the cohesiveness of this group and to maintain morale, which is something very important.
Today, President Trump said that he's going to cut off or substantially reduce foreign aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras as the caravan of Central American migrants are crossing the Mexican border. And so two things, because we've got just a couple minutes left. So I want to talk about that and then speak to the fact that everything that Donald Trump seems to be doing to stop the flow of these migrants really seems to be in violation of international law, because at a minimum, people should be allowed to come to the border and seek asylum.
And would you say has a lot of strong points? Now, from legal perspective, as a lawyer, I will say that due to international protocols, international treaties of which the United States remains a party of, and thank goodness from my perspective, I have not heard of the United States withdrawing from these asylum-related treaties as of yet. Who knows what's going to happen next year? But as of now, we're okay.
Or tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. We'll see, though. So that each nation has its own autonomous right to decide how it processes individuals. And in terms of people reaching the border and trying to seek asylum, I will tell you, it is difficult, especially nowadays, in order to get further than the border. And by that, I mean, if you're picked up, you're taken to a detention center. If you're taken to a detention center, oftentimes what I see happen is that they reach out to family members via phone, they call up my office, I try to visit them, learn about their case, and I give them an honest evaluation of what their chances are of getting out based on the strength of their case. And what I have to continue to remind your listeners of is that even though someone may be at risk of really dying in their home country, that in itself is not enough to get asylum, and that in itself is not enough to show you have, quote-unquote, a credible fear of persecution. And what that means is you have a clear possibility of potentially winning your asylum case. And unless you show that credible fear, you're not going to get out of detention. You're going to remain there. And I should emphasize, this is the civil immigration detention facilities, not the whole criminal prisons that the president has insisted on taking people through under this so-called zero-tolerance policy, which I would say was a very low-tolerance policy even before he decided to make this into a political issue earlier this year. So even though many individuals are able to seek asylum, and that is not so much an individual right, but rather a, shall we say, a requirement of the government, not so much an individual right, but a requirement by the government per international agreements, the way in which they're processed and how, shall we say, successful they will be in making their case, that does vary significantly from country to country based on their own domestic national laws.
And quickly, we have about a minute. The president threatening to cut off or substantially reduce foreign aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
If I were those countries' governments, I would say, you know what? If you're going to make things worse for us, there's even less incentive for us to prevent our citizens leaving the country. Because when they do, they might be able to find a better life there. They might be able to avoid dangerous situations here at home. They might be able to send back remittances, which for the purposes of El Salvador, at least at one point in time, was their number one source of foreign income. Number one source of foreign income, American dollars from nationals there.
Carlos Castaneda from Garcia and Garcia Law Firm in San Antonio, Texas. Thank you so much for your time. As always, greatly appreciate your coming on board when we call. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton is facing 2 days of high-level talks in Moscow, which began today after President Trump announced his intention to withdraw from the landmark nuclear weapons treaty, the INF treaty. What threats does this pose going forward in the context of nuclear proliferation? For this, we turn to my next guest. She's the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and serves on the coordinating committee of World Beyond War. She wrote the piece, "The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons is Honored with a Nobel Prize." She wrote that for The Nation. She is Alice Slater. Ms. Slater, thank you and welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So when you heard President Trump announce that he was withdrawing from the INF treaty, what were your thoughts?
My thought is that he's a rogue elephant and he's making more trouble is my thought. But what we do about it is another story because, we withdrew from another treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that we signed with the Soviet Union in 1972, and Bush walked out of it. And that was a treaty that was designed to stop the missile race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and it had a big effect on nuclear disarmament. This intermediate nuclear treaty was the weapons we had stationed in Europe, the smaller ones, and it was negotiated with Reagan and Gorbachev. Now, at that time, Gorbachev wanted to negotiate for total nuclear disarmament, but Reagan would not give up the U.S. plans for Star Wars, which had a mission to dominate and control the military use of space. So Gorbachev pulled back from the offer to eliminate nuclear weapons, and they just negotiated the one that eliminated these short-range missiles in Europe that was stationed there. So that's the INF treaty.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that we had 122 countries last summer negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. They're prohibited. They're illegal. You can't have them. Just like we've done for chemical and biological weapons. We never did that for nuclear weapons. We had this non-proliferation treaty. We have five countries, U.S., Russia, England, China, and France, promised to give up their weapons if everybody else promised not to get them. And everybody signed the treaty except for India, Pakistan, and Israel, and they got them. So then there were eight. And the dopey treaty that didn't really ban nuclear weapons gave everybody a promise to an inalienable right for peaceful nuclear power. So North Korea, they were a member. They got their peaceful nuclear power and left and made a bomb, because that's how you make a bomb, from a peaceful nuclear reactor. So that's what we had. And then the world was so upset with the promises that were made in 1970 in the Non-Proliferation Treaty that we were going to give up or make good faith efforts to get rid of our nuclear weapons, that they decided, no, we're going to make them illegal, we're going to prohibit them. And this took a 10-year campaign, and last year the treaty was adopted. We won the Nobel Prize, which was a lot of fun, because it was a whole bunch of grassroots campaigners. You know, there was no famous person. And we now have that treaty, and of course none of the nuclear weapon states are supporting it, you know, or the NATO states that are in the U.S. nuclear umbrella, or some of the stands that go along with Russia. They don't want to support this treaty. So my proposal is, since this is Sputnik, I assume it's being heard in Russia, we have so many nuclear weapons. Every time Russia made an offer to us, we always turned them down and went ahead, and then they always caught up. I mean, Stalin said to Truman in 1945, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, turn the bomb over to the UN. We were allies. We had just created the United Nations to end the scourge of war. And Truman said no. So, of course, Russia got the bomb. I mean, as I said, Gorbachev wanted Reagan to give up the bomb, but Reagan wouldn't give up Star Wars. So they did the INF, you know, which was an intermediate measure. Putin offered to Clinton to cut all our weapons to 1,000 each. We had like 18,000. Now there are 16,000. 15,000 are in the U.S. and Russia. So if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it. Anyway, Putin said, please, let's do this, and we'll call everybody a table and get rid of all the nuclear weapons, but don't put missiles in Eastern Europe. And Clinton wouldn't agree to it. And there are now missiles in Romania and then in Poland, and Bush walked out of that treaty not to put missiles. And we also promised Gorbachev when the wall came down that we would not expand NATO. And now NATO is right up to Russia's border. I mean, and we're doing military maneuvers, the U.S. So I, as an American citizen, feel that we've been very provocative. But I think Russia's got to get wise up. The answer to us doing more is not for them to do even more. It's to gang up on the United States. Russia, China, India, those countries should get together and say, we want to sign the ban treaty, because there's a way for nuclear weapon states to sign. It's, if you were to sign the ban treaty as a nuclear weapon state, you would wait until everybody signed, and then you'd have an inventory, and we'd inspect each other's arsenals to make sure we got rid of them, which we're very good at doing. I mean, the U.S. and Russia reduced their nuclear weapons from 80,000 to 15,000. Not as if one isn't bad enough to kill a whole city.
I was just thinking, when you've got 15,000 and all you need is one.
Exactly. So for Putin to be, he's building new nuclear weapons. He said so in March, because he has not been able to get the U.S. to agree not to expand the missiles, not to do these military maneuvers in NATO, which make them feel very threatened. I mean, look what happened when Russia put nuclear weapons in Cuba, the Soviet Union, and we almost had World War III, you know. And part of the deal that Kennedy made with Khrushchev to get the weapons out of Cuba, which he didn't announce, it was done secretly, because if he had announced it, you'd have all these warmongers and Congress wouldn't have let him. But the deal was that we would take our missiles out of Turkey, which we did. A year after Russia moved out of Cuba, we moved out of Turkey, and we're back in Turkey. The U.S. keeps nuclear weapons in five NATO countries, Turkey, Belgium, Germany, Holland, and Italy. So, you know, I understand where Russia's coming from, but they've got to be a little smarter. They don't need any more nuclear weapons, no matter how many we build. I mean, even though it doesn't matter if they just have one. I mean, look at how nuts we're going with North Korea has 10, you know. I mean,
let me ask you this. In terms of China, part of what I read was, or part of what I understand Trump's logic to be with getting out of this treaty is, well, we need to bring China in. So he crazily, I'll make up a word, seems to think that by undoing the treaty with Russia, he can then bring China to the table instead of just figuring out a way to bring China to the table with Russia already there, if in fact that is his true motivation. Have you heard that as well?
Who knows? He is like a loose cannon. He campaigned of, I'm going to make a deal with North Korea. I'm going to make a deal with Russia. What do we need NATO for? And then the Democrats and the Republicans wouldn't let him go near any of that because this country is in the grip of what Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, called
the military-industrial complex.
I call it the military-industrial academic media. It's not everybody's in on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the government is so corrupt. They voted the biggest defense budget this year, bigger than any. I mean, we're not even in a war, and only 34 Democrats voted against it. It's not just Trump.
Right.
You know, and so I think, you know, with where we're seeing the breakup of the patriarchy in a way, and things are breaking up. The U.S. is not such a sole hegemon anymore. You know.
Well, there are those who will argue to your point, and I think they're correct. That there was a time in the world when the adage was the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well,
right.
Now it looks as though the American Empire is waning.
Right, and Trump is helping it. He's so obnoxious that everybody's running away from him. So this is a good moment for Russia and China and India to gang up on America and say, we want to sign the ban treaty. We don't want to make nuclear weapons. I mean, China's always been very reasonable. They always had no first use. They never made more than a couple of hundred bombs. I mean, it's only U.S. and Russia with the two guerrillas on the block with thousands of nuclear weapons. And, you know, we're not going to have nuclear war because a president decides to push the button. That would be nuts. Nobody's deliberately going to bomb New York or Moscow because they know they'd be totally destroyed. What's going to happen is an accident. We've had so many near misses. We've just been so lucky. I mean, God has been watching out for us. There was a Russian colonel in the Soviet missile site, Colonel Petrov. They did a movie about him. That his orders, if he sees a certain kind of incoming stuff on the computer, he's got to let go of all the missiles on New York and Washington. Anyway, he got this signal coming in, and there was like a lot of taut moments, and he decided to wait, and it turned out it was a computer glitch, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And they were mad at him because he didn't really follow orders. He was supposed to, as soon as he saw that, he was supposed to unleash everything. And just about 4 years ago, we had missiles, a plane loaded with six missiles with 36 bombs on them in Minnesota that went somewhere, it went to an airport in Louisiana, and they didn't even know they had the nuclear weapons aboard, and they were missing for 36 hours till they found out what happened to them. I mean, this is the kind of stupid things that could happen in Russia and America. It's so dumb to even think of making one more nuclear weapon. You know, all you need is like 10 to scare somebody. That's what North Korea is doing. We don't need, you know, Russia said they're making new ones, and then we're going to make smaller, more usable nukes. I mean, what is that? That's as big as Hiroshima, Nagasaki, because that's the trigger for the hydrogen bomb that's magnitudes more powerful.
And now you even have, I believe, in Japan, they are moving away from what up to this point had been a very stringent non-nuclear footprint.
Well, Japan is phony, too, because Japan has been enriching uranium for years. Nobody stopped them like we tried to stop Iran. You know, that's what the Iran deal was. You know, they had their peaceful nuclear power. And Iran, I was in Japan in 1995, and I met with Mayor Akiba, who at that time he was a parliamentarian from Hiroshima, but then he became the leader of Mayors of Peace. And I met with him in 95, and he said, Japan has the bomb. I said, what are you talking about? He said, we have all the material. We have the technology. I said, how long would it take? He said, 3 months. And that's what we were afraid that Iran was doing, although Iran said they weren't doing it. But because it's Iran, you know, and there's so much hatred left over from when we assassinated their president in 1953, we never talk about that.
We never talk about Mohammad Mossadegh.
Right. And that was because he nationalized the oil from the English of the British oil. So we're in a great moment right now, as dangerous as it seems.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but no one talks about the Atoms for Peace program and how the United States sold a lot of this technology to some of the very countries who we now are so afraid have nuclear capabilities.
And do you know who we want to sell it to now? Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Vietnam, Turkey. They never had it. I mean, that is like insane, you know. It's insane. It's boy toys stuff. It's like, you know, we've just shut down our nuclear power plant, Indian Point. It's going to shut down in another year on 25 miles from New York, which the 911 attackers had it in the target. They were considering it, and it would have been like Fukushima or Chernobyl in New York City. We couldn't have even evacuated all these people. And instead, luckily, they only hit the World Trade, you know. I mean, the World Trade Towers, that they made that decision, but it was in their documents. The 911 Commission found it. So, and they're still building new ones. We don't know. Like, we're shutting it down. We have no idea what to do with the waste. It lasts for, like, 300,000 years. It's poisonous. I mean, all of recorded history is 5,000 years. All we can do right now is stop making more, keep it in a good concrete cask. Don't bury it, because who knows what's going to happen in 300,000 years. You know,
let me read a couple of quotes I believe are from your latest piece. Now is an opportunity to take a timeout on nuclear gamesmanship, new threats, trillions of wasted dollars on weapon systems that Presidents Reagan and Gorbachev acknowledged back in 87 at the end of the Cold War could never be used, warning that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And you also wrote, an honest appraisal of the bad actors in this fighting scenario for the destruction of all life on Earth must conclude that the U.S. has been the constant provocateur in the relationship.
I know that I've given you some of the times where Russia was making offers to us that we rejected. And, you know, another one, this has nothing to do with nuclear, but Putin proposed to Obama, I have it in the New York Times, big headline, that we negotiate a cyber war ban, because we were boasting with Israel that we had attacked Iranians' enrichment facilities with the Stuxnet virus, and the U.S. rejected it. And China and Russia keep tabling a treaty in the U.N. Committee on Disarmament where you need consensus to discuss it. They did it in 2008 and again in 2015, a treaty to keep weapons out of space, and the U.S. blocks it. So this is what a bad actor the U.S. is, and it's driven by corporate military greed. I mean, there's so much money involved. This new Cold War with Russia is because we just can't spend enough money on terrorism anymore. So we need a new enemy so that Boeing and, you know, Trump was in such a quandary about whether he should go against this horrible Saudi government that dismembered a journalist because he said, what's going to happen to our military contract? I mean, he even said it. I mean, usually they're not nice enough to say.
And the thing about that,
he doesn't even know how bad it sounds, but he did. He was
and
saying,
Alice,
you know,
the thing about that is the number that Trump keeps quoting isn't even a real number. And the number of jobs that he keeps talking about this weapons or these weapon deals creating, the number grows every day because it's not real.
It's below. But let me tell you something. What I wrote in my longer article, we had just got a report last month from the Intercommittee Panel on Climate Change that they had miscalculated and that things are even worse than they thought, and that if we don't gear up within 10 years, we're going to have catastrophic climate catastrophes.
Right.
And that means like World War II or a Manhattan Project or a Put a Man on the Moon Project. we've got to, like, stop everything and do only solar and wind and efficiency and hydro and just cut out all the nuclear and the fossil and the biomass. They want to, this new guy in Brazil wants to cut down the Amazon. I mean, the trees are like the lungs of the planet. It's slowing down the carbon in the atmosphere. So anyway, you know, plants eat carbon. That's like they're our friends helping.
Right.
Anyway, that's what we should be doing. And I put in a special plea. You know, Germany is very concerned because that treaty was the land-based missiles in Europe.
Yes.
You know, so they'd be more in danger. And I put in a plea for Europe to be our older brother. I mean, America's very stupid and innocent. We never had an attack here. I mean, the only attack we ever had was the World Trade Center, where 3,000 people died. Russia lost 29 million people to the Nazi onslaught. I mean, I went to peace meetings in Germany, you know, in the 80s and 90s. They were so fiercely for peace. They had suffered. Europe really suffered, like the civilians and the bombings and the, you know, the decimation of their cities. We had nothing like that in America, so we're very naive and stupid. And I think if Russia and China and India, or just Russia and whoever else, said, I'm going to join the ban treaty and I'm not going to make new weapons, whatever, I have enough. They don't have to make bigger, smaller, better, faster. I mean, that's ridiculous. Any of them are terrible. They have enough. I mean, like, that's sensible. Then they could be the leaders and America would hear this.
Yes.
Because we're not hearing anything in America. We don't know from nothing. You know, with the press is corrupt, but that would be news. And we've done public opinion polls starting in the 90s when the NPT was up for renegotiation. Like 87% of Americans want to get rid of nuclear weapons. Nobody really wants the bomb. Everybody knows it's horrible. If there would be a country that would step up on the stage, I really hope Putin and Lavrov will do this, you know.
Right.
I just think they know, but like they were trying with Obama. They tried with Bush. Gorbachev tried with Reagan, but now they got to speak to the whole world.
Alice Slater, I got to stop you there. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for your work, and I look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Trump administration considers elimination of transgender recognition. Donald Trump's administration is considering revoking civil rights protections for transgendered people and requiring Americans to identify as the gender listed on their birth certificates. What does this mean for that community? And is this a precursor to an attack on civil rights going forward? For analysis of this, we turn to my next guest. He's a behavioral health expert and analyst and political commentator, Dr. Cleo Monago. Dr. Monago, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It would be good talking to you.
So the Trump administration is considering narrowly defining gender as a biological immutable condition determined by genitalia at birth, the most drastic move yet in a government-wide effort to roll back recognition and protections of transgendered people under federal civil rights law. Your thoughts on this attack?
First of all, feel free to question me as you always do, because sometimes what I say, because it's not part of the normal narrative, it can be peculiar to people. But anyway, the white supremacist, white nationalist right wing does not like homosexuality because they are concerned about reproduction and their numbers and procreation. And anybody they feel that could disorient that or make that a challenge, they want to get rid of anything along those lines.
They also want to attack anything that they perceive to be an attack on traditional marriage.
Well, yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, it's traditional marriage is code for heterosexual marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it goes back to an attack on homosexuality. There's always been an attack on homosexuality among people who are derivative of the Victorian era, which the right wing was born in from. And they're concerned about homosexuality and the apparent lack of reproductive capacity from their perspective, or the interruption of reproduction from their perspective, that can occur if you affirm homosexuality and or transgender, being transgender. It's the same thing from their perspective. So this is really an indirect attack on homosexuality, which they, I think, are apprehensive to do directly because of so much, all the power that the gay community, which is white homosexual male led, all the power they've gained, they don't want to go there yet. They're going to go for what they think is lower hanging fruit, which is transgender people. But again, like you said, it's kind of trying to derail anything that might challenge the so-called nuclear family, if you will.
And so do you see this? Well, so let's look at this. First of all, the Obama administration provided additional latitude in terms of definition of gender and extended protections to the transgendered community. The Trump administration is now coming behind the Obama administration and doing the best that it can to unravel those protections. Do you see this as not only an attempt to attack homosexuality, but do you also see this as an attack on civil rights across the board?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, Donald Trump and his people or group want to attack everybody that's not in their group and everybody who they feel like feel is a threat to their group and their agenda of making white America great again. So, yes, but Obama's name is being used, but this Obama just happens to be the person who got in the way of their agenda. It's not about Obama or even his policies. It's about reversing anything that is a threat to the white heterosexual nuclear family and the reproduction of white people who are very concerned about their lack of capacity over many decades now. And it's become even more clear that they're having a problem reproducing. They're killing themselves in higher numbers, and their fertility rate is lower than it's ever been before. So Trump and company is very serious about dismantling anything that's going to get in the way of them producing, therefore staying in power, because as you know, so-called minorities are going to be the majority. And that's a whole other conversation because they're not necessarily will be black, but so-called minorities will be the majority in about 25 years. And whites are trying to desperately curtail that. And Trump has been their man.
One of the things that I find interesting when you read the memo that came from the administration is they are pinning their analysis or their definition in terms of gender as that being that is scientifically provable. And so in this instance, they're turning to scientifically provable evidence of gender. But for example, on the climate change issue, they run as far away from science as they possibly can. So they seem to want to use science when it's their friend and when it works towards the end that they're trying to accomplish, but they want to deny science when science does not work to what they perceive to be to their benefit.
Because in both instances, their concerns for real are not being articulated. For example, they're concerned about not making the climate issue a thing is because capitalism and its destructive outcomes is connected to any type of interference of what they're doing, which is destroying the ozone layer, et cetera. They don't want that to be tampered with because they're more concerned about capitalism than the ecosystem. When it gets to so-called science and transgender issues, being transgender is irrelevant on a human level in terms of it does not stop anything, it does not hurt anything, it's not really a problem unless you're concerned about homosexuality and a lack of reproduction of white people, which is their concern. You know how Trump is. Trump will make up science. And Trump's people will make up science. They're using science as an excuse and as a convenience in this instance. But the bottom line is that no matter what science says, that a man decides to be transgendered or a woman decides to be transgendered is really irrelevant in the material sense, but it's not irrelevant from their perspective in the reproductive sense. And that's their concern.
The new definition that they're looking to impose would essentially eradicate federal recognition of the estimated 1.4 million Americans who have opted to recognize themselves surgically or otherwise as a gender other than the one that they were born into. Interesting that this discussion surfaces less than, 2 weeks or less than 3 weeks before the midterm election.
Yes. If there are nothing else, they're strategic. So, yes, of course, it's right before the election because they want to influence how things go forward. They're desperate.
But the interesting thing to me about this is, unlike a lot of midterms of in the past, the lines here, to me, are the lines of demarcation are pretty clear. They're pretty well drawn. I don't know that there are a whole lot of people that are still standing on the sidelines deciding which way they're going to vote. I mean, when we look at early voting now, the numbers for early voting are through the roof compared to where they've been historically. So in midterms past. So taking this stand now, I don't know who else there is left to persuade here. Are you seeing it that way?
Well, desperation doesn't depend on logic.
That's true.
And Trump and people like Trump have done these kind of things before at the last minute and have what looks like success. I mean, Trump is the president. And a lot of the statistics and polls before he became president said that he was not going to win. And a lot of the projections, even in the media before he became president, even shortly before the announcement, was projecting that he would lose. And as you know, a lot of TV shows, Saturday Night Live, a lot of satirical places kept on putting Hillary Clinton in the presidency. So they're not concerned about all this material stuff and logic you're talking about. They're desperate. And frankly, some of their tactics have worked. So they're doing what they can do.
But here's the thing. We hear now on a number of talking head shows that the polls were wrong, that as you just articulated, the polls articulated that Trump was going to lose, that Hillary Clinton would be our next president. But the interesting thing is when you look at the work of people such as Greg Palast, who went into Arizona, went into Michigan, went into and looked at the numbers of those who were disenfranchised through voter suppression tactics, Trump didn't win Arizona. Trump didn't win Michigan. Trump didn't win Ohio. Trump didn't win North Carolina. And so if you look at the voter disenfranchisement tactics, the voter suppression tactics, he really didn't win. So it's not that the polling was bad. It's that then and now people are not looking at the success that the voter suppression tactics played on the outcome of the election.
I agree with that completely. And I think that people get disoriented and shocked at the level of despicable behavior, scheming, and treachery that occurs. I mean, George Bush, when George W. Bush took his presidency drive to the White House when he won the second time, won in quotes, they threw eggs at him. You might remember
right.
that. I mean, his limousine, he had to get an extra set of bodyguards to let him out of that, the winning president, quote unquote, to let him out of his limousine to go back into the White House. So these people are not concerned about these logical facts that you're talking about. They know how to do what they want to do. And George W. Bush was the president anyway, and Donald Trump was the president anyway. And they believe that if they create confusion and create a whole lot of distractions, they can get what they want even at the last minute. And they have. I mean, do you believe that Trump is on the verge of impeachment?
No. Oh, no.
Exactly.
No. And Nancy Pelosi made that very clear when John Conyers was when the last time the Democrats were about to take control of the House and John Conyers was talking about going after Bush. And Nancy Pelosi said, no, sir, please stand down on this issue. We are not doing this.
Exactly.
That's not about to happen.
No. And frankly, and I've said this before, people have looked at me sideways, but one of the reasons I don't trust the polls is because there's a lot of white people who know what to say in terms of a public script, not to become controversial and seen as racist, who are going in the polls and doing other things. I mean, people were shocked.
Especially when an anonymous pollster is calling your home. There are a lot of people who are not, based upon all of the pushback and all of the negative rhetoric and all of the racist rhetoric that is associated with Donald Trump. There are a lot of people who will not admit to an anonymous person on the other end of the phone, yeah, I'm down with that guy.
Yeah, exactly. And just one more thing. When it comes to logic, decency, democracy, I hate to warn people who are listening, but this country was not founded on that. Not even the Democratic Party, which has got the word democracy in its name, was founded on democracy. It was founded on partisan politics and agendas. And what's going on right now with Donald Trump and even this transgender issue, the overarching agenda is to get rid of anything that's going to interrupt the production of the white nuclear family. And one day you might want to talk about Black people being used as surrogates to produce white and light-skinned people for many generations to recreate white people in this country and how they're working on that.
Now, wait a minute. If I understand dominant genes and recessive genes, all that I've seen throughout history, I don't understand the science of how when you interject a African gene into the pool, that from the science that I've seen is the dominant gene.
Well, white supremacy is not concerned. First of all, race, as we already know, is a construct. It's an illusion.
Race is an artificial construct. So people understand there is no biologically definable, provable element called race. It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
If you go to Argentina, if you go to Peru, if you go to Brazil, despite the fact that it doesn't exist, there are constructs. And one of the most powerful, coercive, manipulative, dangerous, and serious constructs in the Western world is a construct called white. And it's based on something very superficial.
And go to Spain. Go to Spain as well.
Exactly. And there are other places. So we're going to go by science. We would call a whole bunch of people Black.
Right.
Who are based on the current definition, based on what you're saying. But there's a whole lot of people who are not going to be bothered with. You've heard of Jennifer Beals, the actress?
Yeah.
She often identifies as white, and she's half Black. Because white has more social capital and protection in the Western world.
That is true.
And when you bring in the self-hate element that a lot of Black people are induced into falling for, we're going to have a lot of people. Look, they're purposely putting on the census interracial and biracial.
Right. In fact, I'm glad you brought up the census, because I believe there's a category non-white Hispanic.
Yes.
As though there is a white Hispanic category.
Exactly. And if you're Egyptian, so-called, or North African, you have to call yourself white according to the United States Census. This is all relevant to the recreation of the mirage of whiteness, so people who can replicate that aesthetically can stay in power. So this fact about one drop stuff, they've changed the strategy. That's a whole other show and a whole other conversation. But we need to leave the former strategy of interracial people making that some type of problem among white supremacists. There's elements of it who are pushing it and actually affirming it, because they know that over time, like what happened in Brazil and these other places, people become lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter. And the other issue around this agenda is to make people disloyal to Blackness. See, if you're mixed, you're no longer loyal to Blackness in a white supremacist, white bias society. It works like a charm, despite these scientific perspectives that you just raised. Loyalty is the issue.
Where you just took the conversation was the subtext of my question, which is this attack on the civil rights of the transgendered actually a broader attack on civil rights across the board?
Of course. Yes. But I want to recontextualize that by saying that It's a...
You always got to recontextualize something. Anyway, go ahead.
Because people, a lot of people aren't having these conversations, man. You're the wonderful, strange one who's bringing up these rare perspectives that don't get on the you know, in this ethos that much.
That's why I'm on Radio Sputnik.
Exactly. So, I mean, civil rights has a generic sound to it.
Yes.
We need to be specific here. This is an attack against anything that interrupts the reproduction of white people, which is under attack by nature. Because we ain't doing it. They're doing it to themselves. But they don't want anybody who's going to interfere with their agenda to win and to stay in control and to stay around as the most powerful group, despite the scientific lowering of their numbers. They don't care about that. And again, in case these tangents have gotten some people listening, like, what the hell's going on? The attack on transgender people is simply a veiled attack on homosexuality. And they're going to go to that next if they can, but they're starting off here because they think it's going to cause less controversy because the gay community, which is white homosexuals, I got to say that again, it's not a multicultural rainbow like people think, because the white gay community has so much power. So they're attacking subsets.
Got it. And just so no one will confuse what you're saying, you are not equating transgendered and homosexual. You're just saying that the attack on the transgendered community is the subtle attack on the homosexual community.
Exactly.
And okay.
You heard the term LGBTQ.
Right.
Well, this is the T
right.
in the LGBTQ.
Right.
But it's considered one problem.
Got it. By those on the conservative side of the equation.
Yes.
Got it.
So-called conservative.
Got it. Got it. Dr. Cleo Monago, as always, man, you always bring it, and you clarify and you contextualize as none others can do. My man. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I do what I can, man. Right,
and you do it well. You do it well. Thank you, man. God bless you.
I appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. And this has been show 100. On to show 200. Be safe, peace, and blessings. I'm out.